We come now to what is an offensive story about Noah and his sons. The reason why it's offensive, and I'll try to, before we take up our Bible in detail, just give you an idea. It tells about how the patriarch Noah, who is the inventor of wine, drinks of the wine, and after he gets drunk, lies uncovered and shamefully exposed and is mocked by his disrespectful son, Ham. More than that, it tells that on sobering up, after he's sobered up, the patriarch curses this son to be a slave of slaves, the lowest of slaves. Well, people kind of wonder, what does this mean? Now, I don't know whether you understand this or not, but earlier interpreters made a racial interpretation of this. And it is still very strong, all over. And therefore, I'm going to talk about it. Not just with the Aryan nation, those people who are now standing trial for some offensive and potentially illegal activities out here in the Pacific Northwest. You know what I mean, the Aryan Nation group? It's in Idaho. They're kind of white supremacists. They're very anti-Semitic and so forth. This is a very, very common and a long-standing interpretation. It simply says that of these sons of Noah, one was white, Japheth, one was black, Ham, he's the one that's cursed, and one was yellow, Semites. It doesn't really fit because the Semites are anything but yellow. But, you know, the common people just don't make distinctions, don't want to make distinctions. When you've got it in for the Jews and the anti-Semites and you want to be top dog yourself, this was a common thing. But this is actually the interpretation that I learned as a young boy in pre-theological school. I learned a little better in the seminary, but I learned that as the main one. I wonder, we have some disturbance up there.
So, yeah, what was it?
Could you be quiet up there, please?
That's our girl. She's trying to.
Pardon?
I think they're trying to.
Yeah, okay, all right, good. Well, they have perhaps some problems, but I don't know. But it does disturb me. See, what people have said, this foreshadowed the future history of the world. That supremacy is given to the white people, to the Indo-Europeans, to the descendants of Japheth. And subservience is the God-given and God-ordained lot of the descendants of Ham, the black people, the black race. True religion is characteristic of the descendants of Shem. And from them come the chosen people and the Messiah, Jesus Christ. World leadership, as I said, should go to the Indo-Europeans, and because they're going to enter the tents of Shem. Shem has left, they didn't accept the Messiah Jesus, and so they left those tents, they're empty, and so the Indo-Europeans have become the inheritors of their whole culture, and they live there now, and they will have, God will enlarge Japheth. He will dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan will be a servant, and they will have rulership. This was not only taught to me as kind of the future of all of world history, and it was done, and I went to a very good prep school, and they were not racist themselves, but this was the old tradition. And I remember as a graduate student at University of Chicago, I and some friends often attended St. Philip's Lutheran Church down in the black ghetto of Chicago. And they had a black minister. His name was Marmaduke Carter. He could sing the liturgy. He was just a marvelous person. He knew what the gospel was, and we all liked him. But once when we were talking about the beginning, this was way in the 40s, you see, way back when, of the civil rights movement and so forth, and we talked to him, because I belonged already at that time to the Lutheran Human Relations Society, and we were discussing these problems. And his response was, and he had learned that at the seminary too, he said, "We are the cursed people. We black people are the cursed people." He was referring to Noah's curse. And people were taught in those days that that was their lot. And in his case, he simply accepted it. And that was it. Now, today, we modern people shy away from such a racist interpretation, isn't it? Why do you think we do it?
Don't want to create any disturbance, I guess.
We've had enough of since the Nazis, you know, blue-eyed, blonde, master race people, and we know what bitter fruit that can have, and we know in our own country. And though that was, I think, a glorious time of the civil rights, and I lived in Chicago during all of that, when the weathermen started breaking the windows, and I said to myself, "I wonder if this is the movement that I should be in." And you know what I'm talking about. So we have seen what bitter fruits. I think there's more to it than that.
Don't you think we don't like to admit that we're racist?
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you'll seldom hear this story retold from, let's say, a Lutheran pulpit or a Roman Catholic pulpit. Like it had been, undoubtedly that had been done. And I think I read Hebrew regularly with an evangelical pastor from Gig Harbor, and he said that when he went to Dallas, Texas seminary, that his professor of Old Testament was really against this whole thing, because it was still very, very prevalent in the South. Don't you remember that when we had the first integration of the Little Rock High School, blacks and whites going to school together, Governor Faubus was against it for two reasons. One, they are scientifically proved that they are inferior. And secondly, it was against the Bible. Against what? Genesis chapter 9. And so that's largely an American sort of thing. But you are absolutely right, Mr. Schultz, is it?
Yes.
Yes. That there is a lot of prejudice, and we ought to own up to it, especially when we have advantages of it because of our white skin, and not realize what other people go through by not having the white skin that we have. And then I think that this feeds there, and so it has to be spoken of. There's another reason. Are there just three races, black, yellow, and white, in the world? In chapter 10, there are 70 nations. I put down just a scheme of them here. You divide up all these nations way up there, the Japheth nations in the north, then you've got in the middle of Israel's world, you have the Semites in the middle, the Arpaxes is one from whom Abram came, you know, the Arameans, the Syrians, and the Lydians, and the Arpaxes, and the Syrians, and the Elamites. And then down below the south, you have Ham and his descendants down in Egypt. You see that way down into the land of Cush. So that's the Israelite viewpoint. But since we have explored the world, we know that there is such a place as Australia, and we know there's a place like the Orient. And when, in the 16th century, Magellan and all these people began exploring, and they first tried to fit them into descendants from these 70, because they thought there were only 70 nations, you see that, and they had to get some descendants. The Germans came from the Ashkenazim here, and everybody had to find their spot, you see that, otherwise you just weren't quite legit. But the Jesuits especially, and they were out in the mission field, God bless them, and they were honest. They said, there are more people than are mentioned in Genesis 10. There are more peoples. We just know there are more peoples. And they didn't quite know that. And then I think, for me, and I've been kind of hammering this a little hard, I think all of these first, I call them master stories. I think many of you were here when I called them that. They're prototypical master stories. They are the master stories that help us understand the basics of human life. And these are therefore prototypical stories and tells a story about what always happens, not just to one person, but to all humans everywhere in every human community, not just among certain races. And therefore, my suggestion to you is that, and that's what we did in the other class, it's still here, that we take it up rather seriously. First, there's a kind of a transition, the first two verses. Then we have the story of, I call it, the disrespectful son. And then in the last verse, we have kind of an appendix that does talk about nations. The respectful sons, the descendants of Shem. Here we've got Ham. He's disrespectful. And here we've got Shem and Japhet. Remember when their father was naked? What did they do? They took the blanket and went backwards and covered his nakedness. You see that? So my suggestion is this, that Noah is every father who has a weakness and enfeebled. And Ham is every son that is disrespectful of his father and his father's weakness. And that gets God's curse. Whereas Shem and Japhet, that's described in the appendix, are the respectful sons. And they receive God's blessing, which is interesting. And I think if you look at it in those general terms, it makes a little more sense. In other words, I'll be a little pushy here and put everything on the table before we take up the details here. Younger people can disrespect their parents because of their parents' weakness. Doesn't it happen all the time? We're talking about the relationship of older and younger generation, isn't it? And older people, I'm getting there too, can't keep up. That's why it's good for me to retire. Because my last years of teaching, I like teaching, I simply say I don't understand these students as well as I used to. And they're a little different generation. I think we all feel that, isn't it? And sometimes I live in an apartment, a kind of a old condominium with older people, and they complain a lot. I've heard it here at Colden too. How can children be so cruel, you know? And things like that. So this is part of it. And then parents have weaknesses. We know that too. But according to this story, I think such disrespect can endanger the survival of any community. For the continuation of any community depends that the transition, the tradition be handed by parents who had the experience to the young people. So they've got their part to do. And the young people receiving it. You see that? And continuing. This is my fourth time to Holden. And I am amazed that over, say, that was 13 years, the tradition of living together here in community is very, very strong. And things would fall apart very quickly here at Holden with the overturn if you didn't maintain those traditions, if people didn't hand on the traditions of how to, you know, take care of the work and how to divide it all up and do this. And the younger generation would not accept that. And they're still doing it, which makes for a community. It has all the tensions of any genuine community. You have that in the university too, the younger professors and the older professors. And you have that in any business and any community. So do you see what I'm calling this is what? Something that is typical, prototypical of human life from the beginning. So you have not just a story about one bad son who did a bad thing and then maybe his descendants are saddled with that, and two respectful sons, but I think it's much more than that. The monstrous result, that's why there's a curse here, of such disrespectful behavior is that the disrespectful son will become a slave to his own peers, to his own brothers. And to be enslaved, that was a terrible thing in Israelite society. They lived with it, but do you know how long you could be a slave if you lived in Israel? And it was usually debtor slavery. It wasn't our plantation slavery with another race or something like that we have in America. How long could you hold a Hebrew slave if you were an Israelite, according to the Old Testament laws?
7 years?
Six years. Seventh year had to go free. And if there was a debt, the clan had to collect the money, and you had to have a redeemer who would see to it that his freedom was ensured. Sometimes it was less than that, you see that. But it couldn't be any longer than 6 years. Seventh year, he was free. They had very good ways of working at that. But this idea that you should enslave, be a slave forever and ever and ever and ever to your brethren. But I'm afraid that's what happens. Everyone's things break apart in society. And I see peer groups among young people that are just absolutely intolerable. There have been no such tyranny ever by dictators or anything else as the tyranny of young people among themselves. And you perhaps have witnessed that too. And that can happen. So let's take our Bibles and read here. And I don't know all of your names here, and I sometimes get them mixed, so I hope you will bear with me. But we'll start way over here at the right. If you have chapter 9, and we'll just take that first two verses there, the ones that I have up on the board here, verses 18 and 19. Do you mind reading for us there?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Chapter 9, verses 18 and 19. It's kind of the transition to this story.
So Pharaoh called Abraham.
No, I think you must have it.
Chapter
9.
Oh, excuse me.
Sure.
The wrong chapter.
I noticed you were paging there, and I was wondering, where is she going? Okay.
The sons of Noah, right?
Yes.
The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan.
Yes, that's very important. To understand this story, you have to know that Ham was the father of Canaan, okay?
These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled.
Okay. Now, would you mind the next person reading verses 20 and 21? This is chapter 9. Okay.
Noah was the first tiller of the soil. He planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and became drunk, and lay uncovered in his tent.
Okay, so here, what happens? We've got the inventor of wine. Is wine a good thing or a bad thing?
Good thing. It's the overindulgence.
Yes, and overindulgence of being a chronic alcoholic, that's condemned in the New Testament as not being a lifestyle for Christians, you see that, and for a number of reasons, you see that, drunkenness. But in this case, to have wine, some people excuse Noah for getting drunk, saying this, after all, he was the inventor, didn't know how potent it was, and so when he drank it and got drunk, it was quite innocent. And that could be. My German Russians had folk songs, and you know what they would do? They would say, Noah got drunk, so can I. And they had in these folk songs, German folk songs, Solomon engaged in wine and made experiments in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 with wine. And so they were kind of naughty songs. But But I must say, I didn't have in my parish. I have some people close to that, but I must say that they were pretty good people. They were not habitual drunkards and neglecting everything like that. So here, all we have is that he is the first one to plant a vineyard. Do you know, the Semitic peoples, to this day, don't have water. To call a person a water drinker is a killjoy. And the water isn't good, usually, you see that. Not that they don't have water, but what you ordinarily drink is what? You eat bread and you drink wine, isn't it? And that's the common staff of life. And they wouldn't expect that. I told the other people, I better tell you this too, a story that I just recalled as I was teaching here. The first time I went to Palestine in 1954, we were at the American School of Oriental Research, and there were a bunch of teetotaling Presbyterian seminary students from Pittsburgh, from Xenia Theological. But there were four of us, and we hired a taxi guy, a driver. His name was Khalil, and he was an Arab Christian. And so he would take us to all the sacred places, and usually there was a monastery. And he introduced us to the monk that was to take care of us, you see that? And what would those monks do? They would always give you bread and wine. And these Presbyterians would refuse the wine. And finally, after about the third or fourth place, Khalil, his name was, he said, "What kind of Christians are you that you won't drink wine?" And they gave a good answer. They said, "Well, in our country, there's so many people that misuse it that we stay away from it. So it isn't that you can't have it, but we don't have it, and we don't even get close to it." And that was the idea. But in their culture, let me give you an example. Psalm 104, verse 15, I'll just read it for you. Shows you how they looked at this being the natural sort of thing. And one of the great gifts of God. Psalm 104, verse 14 and 15. "Thou dost cause the grass to grow for the cattle, plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the heart of man." So if you come to visit me in the afternoon in Tacoma, I can give you Pepsi or Diet Coke or water or coffee, but I can also give you wine. And it will gladden our hearts and the conversation will flow more freely. I don't know. And then bread to strengthen man's heart. So that was the natural thing. And inebriation in the Old Testament was... not necessarily, in all of antiquity, wrong. Now, it, of course, has the attendant effect that you lose control. And sometimes, in this case, you can become foolish and uncovered and lie there and lose your disrespect. And that was often condemned, no doubt about that. And the farmers in Wisconsin, where I grew up in northern Wisconsin, they didn't have to work on the 4th of July, would come to town and they would get roaring drunk and say hooray for the 4th of July. It was naughty, and of course they got bawled out when they got home, but that was it. And we little boys, you know, the flies would come, some of those guys were stoned, they were really stoned, and the flies would come and wonder, is that a human being or what is it? Now, what is the duty of a son if Noah gets drunk and he lies there uncovered? That's another thing. He's lost his disrespect and exposed. What should a son do?
Cover.
And take him home, isn't it? Take care of him, because, yes. But instead of that, what happens? Would you read the next two verses here, verse 22 and 23.
"And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside."
Yes, he didn't do anything about it, you see that?
he advertised it.
Yeah, advertised it, right, correct.
Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it upon both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness.
No, that's the opposite. You see that?
One was complete respect, and the other disrespect.
Yes, it's disrespect. You see that? That's quite clear. You know, last night, I told you in the last, many of you were there, in this slides of Syria, that at Ugarit, where they found many stories, not only about Baal, but there is a story called the golden bowl that the gods had. And in it, it tells a story about a man who was drunk, and they expected that the son would see that father who was drunk back home safely. That was the Canaanite way of doing it, you see that? So if you were decent in any society, you had to do that. And so these people are decent, aren't they? They cover their father's nakedness, yes. But now we come to the shocker. Verse 24, would you mind reading that? What is your name?
Norma,
all right.
When Noah woke from his wine and knew that his youngest son had done to him,
he sobered up, and then you can take verse 25 too.
He said, cursed be Canaan, a slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers.
Yes, so here we come. Now, this, I think, should shock you. If it doesn't, you haven't understood it. That when he sobers up and finds out what has happened, what his younger son had done to him, then what does he do?
Curses.
Now, Alice, you've been with us always from the beginning here in all these lessons. We have had curses before, haven't we, that God spoke? He cursed the ground for the sake of man, but he didn't curse man. Remember that in chapter 3 in the garden? Some of you may know that story. And Cain, the murderer, was cursed away from the ground. That came a little closer, wasn't it? But here comes actually that cursed be Canaan. Now, but he's actually cursing the one of the Hamites that they knew well. Remember we saw in the introduction there in verse 18 that this is the father, Ham was the father of Canaan. We'll talk a little about that because there's been an updating of this here. We would expect it to be, read what? Cursed be Ham, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But since the Israelites knew that Hamitic people, of the Hamitic people, the Canaanites, they were their neighbors. Didn't I show that in the picture, the slides of how they had this orgies and were dancing there before Baal and in their drunkenness and so forth last night from that great people of the Bible and how they lived? You have to get an idea that this is the way this is what went on, and no wonder the prophets were against this. It was kind of a fertility worship. You see that you engaged in all this fertility. The wine makes you virile and so forth. By the way, does anybody know who made wine? Some of you know your Greek mythology here. You can't expect you to know the Canaanite equivalent. But the god of wine was Bacchus, or Dionysus, correct. And they made wine, you see that, and then gave it. Here, wine is a production of humans. Humans learn how to take the grape juice and ferment it. I suppose then take the wine and making liqueur and brandy and all the different varieties that we have and all the wonderful world of wine. Well, here you have it, and this, I think, should shock you that there's a curse on the disrespectful son. And this is not just patriarchal, I don't think. I think this is human. Could be I think this is non-gender. Could be woman, and it could have women involved in tell the same story from that gender. When the younger generation does not take care of the older, but just sees the weaknesses in the older generation, and there are weaknesses, as all of us know, and therefore mocks it, that tears apart the very fabric of society. society depends upon traditions being given by the older generation to the younger, and the younger receiving that generation, accepting it. You see that? And the experience of the ages and of everything else, we have to have that. We'd have no universities, we'd have no home village, we'd have no common life if you didn't have this. And when someone breaks that, here comes that curse. And notice how he says it's expressed here, that that younger generation representative that breaks that becomes what? A slave, most horrible thing, to his own peers. Instead of living in the wholesome traditions that are handed down, they emancipate themselves and each generation becomes a law unto itself. And that can't be. That's the way I would suggest this be understood. At PLU, I'm teaching younger people. They like this. And I find out, you know, when you have exams, you have to correct what they got. They get this right off the bat. They understand it. It's prototypical also for them, see. And I guess maybe I have some very good students. I wouldn't expect all students to accept it. In fact, it would be nonsense if everybody accepted it. It has to be challenged, or otherwise, you can't just hand on a custom. People have to, the young people have a right to challenge it first, isn't it? And then to accept it. And that's why, as a teacher, I have to often be the devil's advocate. I'm the most liberal person in the classroom. I'm really not. But they're phony liberals if they are. And I have to push them to think their way through it, you see that? But then once they think their way through it, and I think not only think their way through it in the classroom, but in their life experience, and then they simply say yes to it. And they'll hold on to these stories, even though they're very old and ancient stories. They'll be their master stories, and that's what they should be. The master stories by which they understand themselves and the basic realities of life. Now let's see. The next thing that we'd like to go on is to what I call an appendix. The reason why I call this appendix is that the story could well have ended at this point. And if I were preaching a sermon, I think I'd just stop here. And just repeat. But here in this appendix, you take up the other two people. Now, they did what they were supposed to, and they don't necessarily have to be blessed for this. But now we get into something that I don't think is racial, but that is religious, that the Israelites mention. Now, you've got the two respectful sons. And they have two ways here of taking it. The Semites would be, the sons of Shem, that would be, you might say, the Israelites. And the disrespectful Ham is one type of non-Israelite, Gentile if you want, and the Japhethites are another type of non-Israelite. And so over against this non-Israelite who doesn't respect his father and the tradition that he has, you have other type of non-Israelite. And that's how they would perhaps understand this. Now you're getting more people, ethnic type of understanding of this, that there can be people who are in Palestine, and they have those people in Palestine, that are respectful. Let me give you an example. Better use this black one. I'll make a map here, a short version of what I have in the board. If this is Palestine, and that's the Sea of Galilee, that's the Jordan River, this is, see, here's Jerusalem. You had really three types of peoples living in Palestine. You had the old Canaanites, that would be the Hamites, they lived especially up here in that seacoast going up toward Ugarit. You have the Israelites who are living in the hill country here, and this is Jerusalem. And then you have down here Philistines, who are Japhethites. They were non-Semitic and they were non-Hamite. Well, you've heard a lot about the Philistines, haven't you? They had headdresses, they had a different culture. And so I suppose they imagined that there would be a real destiny of these people. Now, when they saw the future of the Israelites here, what does it say here? Could we read the next verse here, please? That's verse 26.
He also said, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave."
Yes. Notice what happens here. As the RSV translates, the Old King James Version translated, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem." You see that? But you can also translate it here, "Blessed by the Lord, my God, be Shem." The reason why he breaks out in blessing and thankings of God is that salvation, and the Israelites who tell this story, not as a prototypical story, but as an Israelite story, part of the history of salvation, know that salvation is coming from Israel. The promises to Abram and the promises of the Messiah. And so they bless the God of Israel. Blessed of the Lord, that's the God of Israel, my God, be Shem. And Canaan, that would be the Hamites, the Canaanites who lived here and were there. And the Israelites, you remember, Joshua had to fight. And there was a long, long, long time before the Israelites, the 12 tribes, claimed that Canaan shall not have dominion. So here you're talking about nations and peoples. But it's more religious than, I think, just purely nationalistic. And you know they fought. Then, when it comes to the next verse, would you mind reading the next verse for us? Verse 27?
God enlarged David, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave.
Yes. The word Japhet also means in Hebrew enlargement. So God enlargement people. it's a kind of a Japhet. And so they are going to spread out. And let Japhet dwell in the tents of Shem. And it seems that, well, you know, the Philistines even sometimes conquered everything over here under Saul and so forth. They had a lot of trouble. And David was the finally one that conquered them, you see that. They dwelt in the midst of Shem. And Canaan was not going to have dominion at all. It will be the servant, and the Canaanites will lose out. Well, as we know, the Philistines lost out, and David made this a united empire and subdued this. The Philistines, he didn't kill them, he wasn't a Hitler. They still lived there, but they didn't have rulership. And he didn't kill the Canaanites either. They lived in those towns and so forth, but they didn't have rulership. And of course, from David's line was to become the final son of David, who would be the Messiah, who would be the final king that would establish worldwide peace and worldwide dominion. And I suppose this, what I'm calling here, the updating of this story, this is the prototypical story here in these five, six verses. Whereas here in this appendix, you kind of see the future of the respectful sons. You see a bit of the way in which now, after the flood, the Israelites are looking at history. And that brings me to two things. First, I'd like you to look at verse 28. Would you mind reading verse 28? We're getting all the way around here. I don't know your name. Yes, if you please.
After the flood, Noah lived 350 years.
And verse 29 too.
And the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died.
In the Babylonian flood story, you know what happens to the Babylonian Noah? His name is Utnapishtim. Because he survived the flood, he was put on a mysterious island way off, surrounded by very dark and terrible waters, but he lived forever. And that's why when famous hero Gilgamesh went and finally got to that place and asked him how he got immortality, he said, because he survived the flood. Notice here in the Bible, Noah dies, doesn't he? And he, after the flood, remember we had the 600 years, so he has 950 years, you see that? But he dies. That's the end of the whole thing. And now I can't go through all these 70 names. Once when I taught in this very room in Holden, Witt was the chairman, and I said, I can't finish it all because I think it was only here a week and a half. And he said, why don't you take the beginning of this section and the end? And I said, well, okay, I will. So I taught chapter 10, and the people loved it. There are 70 names of all kinds of peoples there. No, I can't put 70 on the blackboard. I only tried the one part of them. But they, and you know what 70 is what? 10 times 7, you see that? Mm-hmm. And it gives all the nations. And what it does, though it mentions, naturally, the descendants of Shem, these are the Aaron, what I talked about last night, in Semitic language you call them Arameans. We call them Syrians, but they call themselves, they speak Aramaic, you see that? That's Aaron. And then blood is like Lydia, where Gaddafi is. and here are the, Lydians are in Asia Minor, Turkey, excuse me. And here the Babylonians are Paxid, the Babylonians, and here is Asher, the Syrians, and Elam is way out in modern Iran. But those kind of the Semitic world island in the middle of the world. But then they mention all these other nations. I can't go past all of them. Japheth begat, it'll say Javan, Gomer, Tubal, Meshach, Tiras, and Medai. And then it'll have the sons of Javan, that's the Ionian Greeks, Tarshish, Elishish, Kittim, Rodan, like the island of Rhodes. And Gomer would have Ashkenaz. The Germans said, we come from that. That's why German-speaking Jews are still called Ashkenazim. Maybe you know that. And then you got the Repha and the Togarmath here. And all of these are scattered way off in the north. And down in the south you have the same thing. You've got, first of all, Canaan, because he's the one that is the closest to them. And even though the Canaanites, we would kind of classify them as by their physiognomy of their heads, by the type of language that they have, and by the social conditions as Semitic, the Israelites here put them under Canaan because they had a veneer of Egyptian civilization. And so they had the Canaanites, Put, Egypt itself, and then Cush, which is south of Egypt. And that would be part of what we would say is in Saudi Arabia. And you've got Sabta, Rama, Sabta, Havilah, Seba, and here you have Ramana, Denanim, and Sheba. And there are actually 13 other tribes, Saudi Arabian tribes, that no one knows very much about at all. But whoever wrote this Bible was interested in all of the far-flung peoples, way at the north and way at the south, and they are all God's people. And they're all spreading out here. So you see, what is the Bible doing here? It's simply opening up a universal, saying they all belong to God's people. They've been scattered all over the geographical ages. Well, let's stop there because we can't go any farther and its time is almost out. And but we still have, today we have a little more time. I guess I rushed it a little.
What about the Palestinians? I really don't know where they came from, or I don't know anything about them.
Palestinians?
Yes.
Okay. The word Palestina is the Latin word that the Romans gave to this land. Modern Jews won't use this at all. They call it Israel. Don't you forget it. And the trouble is that, as you know, now I'm getting to politics, but we can't avoid it. There's only a ceasefire there, you see that?
Yeah.
And so there's no real boundaries.
No.
And what is the boundary? When they asked Menachem Begin, that old guy, he said, it's Judah, Samaria, and Galilee. But Galilee, the nations, can extend as far as the Euphrates. Well, they also asked Menachem Begin when he came to Camp David. Jimmy Carter grounded him a little at Camp David. At least he had to sign his name to it. What are you going to do with the Arabs? And the Jews are very good at that, making gestures. They don't belong in this land. You see that?
Yeah.
But that name, Palestine, that the Romans gave to it, Palestina, is the word that the British used when they took it over from the Turks. So of all things, it goes back to that word for Philistines. Palestina, Philistines. Can you see it? So of all things, the Philistines still have their name to that whole land. And the Arabs call themselves Palestinians, don't they? Because they say that's our land. And you know what they say? The Jews say, this land was given to us by God, to Abram and his descendants. And the Arabs answer, yes, but we are the first descendants of Abram. We come from his first son, from Ishmael. And not only that, the last of the prophet Muhammad and his successors, the Caliph Omar, said, this is for the Arabs. So this land belongs to us. You see how there is a contest of religion here. You see that? Religious claims to the Holy Land. Am I getting to what you're talking
about?
Yes, that
clears it up quite well.
Now, I'm glad though that you raised it, because it raises something that I hadn't said that I should say. When all of these nations are mentioned, let me just read it here. It occurs three times. The first time it occurs is in verse 5. These are the sons of Japheth in their lands, by their own languages, by their families, by their nations. The second time it occurs is in verse 20. These are the sons of Ham, by their families, by their languages, by their lands, by their nations. And then the last time it occurs in verse 31. These are the sons of Shem, by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. Now, what is a nation? This is very important. It's not just that there's a nuclear family, father and mother, or an extended family, a clan, or a bunch of clans in a tribe. You see that? But it's people who have... What is the description of a people, of a nation, according to the Bible? It can be linguistic, by their tongues, isn't it? It can be geographic, by their land. It can be political, by their nations, the political setup. But it can also be by their families, racial. So race is involved, you see that? But it's only one of how many factors? Four factors. What people have done in modern times, and the influence of modern science with genes, say that's the only thing, it's racial. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. Our scientists are not going to help us as much, I think, to be genuinely human as the Bible and its tradition. Why? Because the Bible has its center in whom? God, the creator of all peoples. Do you see that? And we'll respect people. Now, I happen to be German-American. My family and race is German, I guess. I don't know how many Poles we've snuck in when we lived in Poland, but it was basically that. Maybe we have some Slavic blood in me. I don't really know what the skeletons are in our family tree. But I speak English. I've learned German, could speak that, but the English is my language. And my territory is where? United States, do you see that?
Sure.
And my political thing happens to be a democratic republic today, the United States of America. Don't you think the Bible is therefore much more open-minded than a lot of people are today? Isn't that what's causing a lot of trouble? The tribes say, we are one tribe here, and we should have our own government and our own nation, and we should have sovereignty, and we're the law unto ourselves. You see that? Whereas here, and we'll see this in the next story, the Tower of Babel, where God changes the languages, you see that? And they go out, that God remains the God of all these people. All we have here in this section that we're getting into from this appendix to chapter 10 is to simply say that God is the Lord of all these far-flung nations. And he has history with each one of them. And it's good to have all these nations. They're all part of the family of humanity. And they can have their own languages, their own cultures, their own customs, their own territories. But God is the Lord over all. And I think this fits very much with our Christian tradition that on Pentecost, at the Tower of Babel, they were scattered in all directions. At Pentecost, even though they're scattered and have different languages, what do they say when the Holy Spirit comes down upon them? Do we not hear each one in his own language the wonderful deeds of God? And so, since Pentecost, God uses not only Hebrew, but all kinds of languages. The rabbis, they still, according to Orthodox rabbis, the oldest language in the world, the one that Adam spoke, was Hebrew. And all the rest of the languages were changed. That isn't what the Bible says, but that's what the rabbis say. rabbis have their own version of that, but we have to wait for that tomorrow. So, any other questions? Yes? Still a few minutes here. I don't know whether it does a lot of sense, but I do think it's nice to study the Bible just the way it is and go from chapter to chapter and to just picking favorite passages. And it's been one of the joys of my life, even now in retirement. I read every 2 weeks with three younger pastors. And they're all good students.
Do you teach anything else besides Old Testament?
Pardon?
Do you teach only the Old Testament?
Oh no, I teach, I bat left-handed and right-handed. And the only way to hit home runs is right-handed. And that's the New Testament, because I am a Christian. In other words, do you see what I'm getting at? Yeah. And I must say, this is one of my prejudices, I have many, but I'll be frank, I don't like the modern way of people being only an expert in New Testament and only in the Old Testament. I think it's all part of one Christian Bible for us to see that. And I think that to know the New Testament, you really have to know the Old Testament cold. Now, the best New Testament scholars are that way, you see that. But our tendency is to be one or the other. And the church very often is the Old Testament doesn't get much of a chance.
That's probably true in many things, like doctors who become specialized in a certain field. They often lack just plain good common sense.
Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think we can be over-specialized. Mm-hmm. But I'm very happy that, see, this is the way it worked out with me. Because I could master German, could preach in German, when I went out of the seminary 46 years ago, they sent me to German Russians out there in South Dakota. And they're a village of 250 people. Was my parish. I was Pope. And that was good. Not just for experience, but it was very nice. They were nice people. They treated me like a king. They would have spoiled me if I'd stayed out there. But then at our church college, Northwestern College in Watertown, Wisconsin, our teacher of Greek went on to the seminary. So they were looking for a young person who they might train up. And I had been a pretty good student in languages, and so they said, we'll have him. My farmers didn't want to let me go. They were kind of angry. But they all, praises the bishop, went down and said, you're going to lose him anyway. He said, he's too good of a preacher for you. So why don't you let him go, and I'll see to it that you get a new pastor with no vacancy, see, in between, because they always feared that vacancy. And then he did. He'll preach German too. And then so I went on. I was only 28 when I became full professor. And then I worked at I was interested in the Bible and all this, but I worked at Greek for two reasons. The old leaders said to me, now if you want to go down and study at the University of Chicago, that's all right. But don't go near that divinity school, because that's not our theology. And secondly, you're too young. You ought to live in the court of the Gentiles for a while, and then when you have some maturity, they told you right from the horse's mouth in those days, then you can study theology. But you're too young to study that. You couldn't specialize so early, you see that? And they weren't against studying theology, but first of all, they didn't want me as a young person to be there. And they wanted me to learn my languages, which I'm very perfectly happy it worked out. So I master those languages and love them, and I got a good background for what I really want to do. On the day I got my doctorate degree, though, from the University of Chicago, I began to read full-time. I'd been doing it already. Gerrit von Rath's Theologie, this Alten Testament, Theology of the Old Testament, and I just knew where my heart was. And when I finally had a vocational change from one of our Lutheran schools to another, then I went full-time in the Bible. I, with a heavy heart, left classics. I still read them, still teach them, but I got into that. So, and I love the Old Testament. I think I did that even as a boy, because it rubs life the way it really is under your nose. You can't get away from it, see? And it's scripture, and so you have Jacob wrestling with God and beating God. I think that's a marvelous way to talk about God. And in the New Testament, people don't want to do that. And that's why they left our culture call all the shots. And I think our culture, we should be counterculture, not just for the sake of being a phony liberal, but we should be against our culture and not just accept everything that our culture gives us, or we're going to get into trouble. And here I think, even in these things like this, that if we have a different view of race and nations and so forth, and one that's from the inspired scripture, I have nothing, no quarrel with the scriptures. The more I find in the scriptures, the more I read it, I think it's more sensible.